Good morning. Welcome to Grand Rounds. This morning, I'd like to introduce a speaker needs no introduction because we've had him speak many times here in the update on internal medicine, Dr. Warren Koopin. Dr. Koopin received medical education from Medical College of Wisconsin. I'm not going to go through all his extensive appointments, but he's currently professor of clinical medicine at the University of Miami and is associate director of the transplant nephrology at Miami Miller School of Medicine. His topic this morning is drug-induced nephrotoxicity. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Koopin.
Hi, good morning. Good morning. Thank you. So actually, I'm not going to talk about transplant. I'll throw that word in once during this talk, but it's actually something completely different. I know you're saying drug-induced nephrotoxicity Tuesday morning before Labor Day weekend. Come on. You know, this is really going to be something exciting, but I'm going to show you how this is really relevant to your day-to-day practice. And so first, you've seen this phrase many times. I was just curious if you know exactly where its origin comes from. So first, do no harm. Primum nocere. So where do you think that was first uttered? What is that part of? So some people would say, well, of course, that's very obvious. Was this guy quizzing us? It's the Hippocratic Oath, of course. Hippocrates said, don't harm your patients. And as you know, that's not really true. This phrase was not in the Hippocratic Oath originally. I will use treatment to help the sick according to my ability and judgment, but never with a view to injury. So it wasn't quite exactly that first do no harm. Hippocrates did say in a separate writing that had nothing to do with the Hippocratic Oath, the physician must have two special objects in view, to do good and to do no harm. So not quite exactly first do no harm. Perhaps this phrase is due to somebody else mentioning it. So this person. So Meryl Streep. Did Meryl Streep, have you ever heard her say those words, first do no harm? And if you're a movie buff like I am on Netflix, of course you have, because she was in a movie that was called First Do No Harm. And so this was a true life story by the producer whose son suffered from severe epilepsy and who was had many side effects, Steven Johnson syndrome, other side effects from all the anti-epileptic medications they were being given. So this was a very poignant, and she actually won a Golden Globe Award for this her portrayal here, and intentionally, all the effort to do good, but all the consequences of medications that may occur. In reality, if you were on a quiz show and they asked you first do no harm, it's actually attributed many years later to the gentleman that's called the English Hippocrates, Thomas Sydenham, who actually described an epileptic type of disease, and he's really the first person that truly came out with that phrase, first do no harm. And I know you're saying, so we don't really intend to do harm, of course. You know, how can a physician actually do harm? And of course, we do it all the time, inadvertently, by our prescription of medications. And most interestingly, we are drug dealers. And you know, the most recent data shows that the average person coming out of a physician's office, a general primary care or family doctor, comes out of that office with 1.6 prescriptions. So it's rare that a patient leaves a doctor's office without a prescription in hand. So we are pharmaceutical mania. We give these patients lots of different pharmaceuticals, and I'm in nephrology, and we'll talk about the specific effects these agents can have on the kidney, but we have to be cognizant. We have to be pharmacists ourselves to understand the possible implications of so much polypharmacy that we're prescribing to our patients with good intentions. Every hospital has a formulary committee, a committee that reviews adverse drug reactions, ADRs. And of course, this is a very important medical legal aspect of our practice. So an ADR, by definition, is of course an unwanted or harmful reaction that's experienced by the administration of a drug or in combination of drugs, unwanted, unintended, of course. But it comes as a consequence of such polypharmacy that we do. This is a very common problem that we see among our medical practices, wherever we practice. It's estimated up to 3 to 7% of all hospitalizations are due to adverse drug reactions. And patients that are already in the hospital, 10 to 20% of patients may experience some form of ADR. So it's something we will experience, and it is a very costly effect for the health administration, for your hospital, possibly even from your medical practices. It's estimated that $330 million a year are spent on adverse drug reactions, $2.2 million a year. And although I and we all may take exception to this definition, it is said, it's always shown in big letters on CNN and the news programs, that adverse drug reactions are a significant cause of death in patients. And it's estimated that it's the fourth leading cause of death between heart disease, cancer, stroke, and higher than car crashes, adverse drug reactions. So it's hard for us to say, is this really true? What kind of data are they using? But this is what is shown by the Human Health Services database, that ADRs account for the fourth leading cause of death in the United States. So this is something we need to be intimately aware of. There's a very famous cartoon with this phrase being mentioned. It's called Pogo, and this is a phrase that's been used many times. It says, we have met the enemy, and it is us. And this character was talking more about pollution in the forest where he lived, but it's also true with many things we do in our lives. Who's responsible? Well, we are. So we're the ones prescribing all these medicines, 1.6 for every office visit. We are responsible for our own problems that we may have created. There are two types of ADRs you should be familiar with. The first is very easy and understandable, type A ADRs. This is the most common. 80% of all adverse drug reactions are expected and predictable because the drug we give carries a relatively narrow therapeutic index. So it's not unexpected that if I give aminoglycoside long enough, I may get some nephrotoxicity. So these drugs are well known to be dangerous, particularly for nephrotoxicity or maybe neurotoxicity. Yet we give them knowing their narrow therapeutic index, and unfortunately, in many cases, we weigh the risks and benefits, and we may get an ADR. That is an expected risk we take as gamblers in our medical practice every day. But then there's the type B ADRs. Type B ADRs, about 20% of all adverse drug reactions are what we call idiosyncratic. I never knew this patient was going to develop this effect. It's just unexpected. It's random. There's no comorbid condition, dosing effect, length of duration of therapy that would have allowed me to expect this to happen to the patient, and completely unpredictable. That's one of the major features we're going to talk about today are the type B ADRs. The kidney is probably one of the most important organs that's susceptible to adverse drug reactions. 25% of blood flow goes to the kidney. So the majority of drugs, if they're not metabolized by the kidney, are getting filtered through the kidney. And so therefore, it is particularly sensitive to the adverse effect of many drugs. The kidney concentrates the urine, so it concentrates drugs. So drugs have a predilection to be concentrated in the tubules and in the interstitium of the kidney. The kidney has many biological functions to degrade and metabolize drugs. So therefore, a drug can be converted into a toxic metabolite in the urine. So of all the organs we speak about, nephrotoxicity is probably one of the most common. Sure, we hear about hepatotoxicity, occasionally pulmonary toxicity, but really the bread and butter of an adverse drug reaction is nephrotoxicity because of these physiologic principles of the kidney: high blood flow, concentrating ability, high metabolic conversion rate. So drugs are particularly dangerous to the kidney itself. In regard to different manifestations of how a drug could affect the kidney, most of it is going to be acute kidney injury, AKI. And you and I have discussed definitions of acute kidney injury in general. It is felt that up to 20% of acute kidney injury in children could be due to drugs, and about 20% of acute kidney injury in adults may actually be due to an adverse drug reaction, especially in the elderly population who may be much more prone to nephrotoxicity because of the polypharmacy that they're on. Drugs can manifest toxicity in the kidney in many different ways. First and foremost, of course, would be it's directly toxic. It causes direct damage to the tubules. So that would be a form of ATN, direct toxicity. Just like ACE inhibitors, you can impair the kidneys to autoregulate to compensate for diminished blood flow. It can indirectly affect the kidney by affecting other organs, such as drug-induced hepatotoxicity, and then hepatorenal syndrome could affect the kidney. Drug-induced rhabdomyolysis, like with cocaine, or more commonly, statins. You give a statin for cardiovascular protection, you get rhabdomyolysis, you get kidney injury, the domino effect. Still a form of nephrotoxicity. Drugs can precipitate as crystals, and we'll give you some examples of those. But the most important topic I want to speak to you today about, because it involves your keen recognition of this disease, are those that cause interstitial disease. an autoimmune effect, a hypersensitivity effect. And if you're not familiar with this and catch it quick enough, it can easily lead to permanent kidney injury. So type A ADRs, just for us to review, were those that were predictable. The patient is heart failure, elderly, low, you know, on polypharmacy. We would, a long duration of therapy. The drug carries its own direct nephrotoxicity. That's a type A ADR. And mostly we see ATN, acute tubular necrosis. It's directly tubular toxic. Or these drugs precipitate in the urine as crystals, like acyclovir, sulfur crystals, that in a state of dehydration, well, we expected it. We said, oh, yes, of course, that's why it caused acute kidney injury. Type B ADRs, a little bit different. Type B ADRs, the most common one that is life-threatening, of course, is the type 1 hypersensitivity. My tongue, my throat, it just closed off. That's not nephrotoxicity, but it is an allergic reaction that we put to the side. We're more concerned about this. Interstitial nephritis, inflammation of the kidney as a result of a classic case of what's called type 4 hypersensitivity, a delayed type of hypersensitivity. We need to be familiar with recognizing this because you're on the forefront of this, and if you're not aware of it and if we don't treat it promptly, we will end up with permanent kidney injury. These are typical examples. There's a laundry list. You have them in all your manuals and on the phone of drugs that directly impact the tubules themselves. This would be a type A ADR. And we're familiar, aminoglycosides, amphoterrible that we call it, amphotericin that we use on the wards, vancomycin, cisplatinum, IV contrast. We're all familiar with the drugs that directly impact the kidney. We expect that if we're not careful with these, they'll cause some nephrotoxicity. And the drugs that form crystals. All these drugs can precipitate in the tubules, not just causing flank pain and stones, but precipitating in all the tubules, causing acute kidney injury. Triamterin, ciprofloxacin, the protease inhibitors, allopurinol, the carbonic anhydrase inhibitors that you use for glaucoma or for migraine headaches. Topamax, for instance, guafenicin. All these can form crystals that can precipitate in the kidney, causing acute kidney injury. We understand these. We are familiar with that. Our topic for today is drug-induced nephrotoxicity with a keen attention to a type B ADR, a delayed type hypersensitivity, an unexpected idiosyncratic event causing acute inflammation of the interstitium, acute kidney injury as a result of interstitial nephritis. We're familiar, as we said, with the type A ADRs. They are predictable. A patient is on vancomycin for MRSA. You're giving it for a few weeks. You measure trough levels. You're trying to keep it from getting too high, 15 to 20. The patient already had some pre-existing chronic kidney disease, and then lo and behold, the kidney creatinine creeps up because of vancomycin-related direct tubular toxicity. Easy. We know that drug can do that. These are the examples of patients with interstitial nephritis. A 55-year-old on Bactrim for a UTI. 7 days later, having fever and a rash. Rash appears that this could be an allergic reaction to the sulfur moiety of Bactrim. The creatinine goes up. The sediment shows granular casts, white cells in the urine, red cells in the urine, sort of an inflammatory sediment. This is an acute allergic interstitial nephritis. Kind of easy for us to know. The patient was doing better, then had a fever and a rash. No one could miss that on any test examination for all the residents and students. But much more common, very common right now, is this scenario. A patient with GERD on a PPI for 3 months, and slowly you notice the creatinine is slightly getting worse over time. Well, they're an older individual. Maybe this is just a natural consequence of hypertension, diabetes, aging, the comorbid conditions. The urine sediment, however, looks funny because it not just has changes of chronic disease, but it has these granular casts that are a sign of acute kidney injury. You've got white cells in the urine, red cells in the urine. So this would be definitely something suspicious that something inflammatory is going on, but no rash and no fever. And if you didn't order your analysis and just showed a slight increase of creatinine, you may just put that off as simply a sign that, well, it just happens, an older person's creatinine slightly higher, a little bit of volume depletion. But there is a war going on in the kidney of this patient, an acute interstitial nephritis, but it lacks all the other consequences of fever and rash like you tend to see with like a sulfur drug allergy. This is due to a PPI, so we really need to understand and recognize this aspect. This whole entity of a type B ADR due to interstitial nephritis can account for up to 10 to 20% of all cases of acute kidney injury, chronic kidney injury, acute kidney injury in the outpatient setting, in the inpatient setting, and then most importantly, chronic kidney disease. There are 23 million people in the United States with chronic kidney disease, and 10% have interstitial nephritis. That's 10% of 23 million. That's a lot of people in who have this disease that maybe goes under your radar. Interstitial nephritis doesn't sound as exotic as glomerulonephritis or the hereditary diseases and ATN, but this is a serious disease that affects a number of people in the community, not just in the United States, but all over the world. All these countries, when you look at the causes of their kidney disease, of course, hypertension, diabetes tends to dominate, but also here in about 10% in every country of the world, chronic interstitial nephritis is an important cause of kidney disease, permanent kidney disease. So recognizing it, interceding, preventing this can affect the lives of a significant proportion of patients, this disease of interstitial nephritis. Why is this important to recognize? Why am I harping on this so much? Why don't we simply just stop the drug, okay? Grand rounds is over, stop the drug, recognizes it, let's go in and finish breakfast. But the important thing is that there's something else you need to do. When you think the words interstitial nephritis, by and large right now, steroids are required, corticosteroids. You would never give corticosteroids for somebody with vancomycin-induced ATN. You would never give it for aminoglycoside or contrast because those are ATN. It's necrotics. Steroids will not help a person with necrosis get better. But a person with inflammation, with a type 4, delayed type hypersensitivity, must get steroids to accelerate the removal of the inflammatory response. And if you don't give steroids promptly, you're left with permanent and irreversible scar tissue. So the fear is this. If you're on that PPI for 3 months and you don't remember and recognize that that could be causing that chronic kidney disease and you allow it to fester over time, that subclinical acute interstitial nephritis turns into chronic interstitial nephritis, turns into chronic kidney disease, turns into end-stage kidney failure, and now you have a patient on dialysis. So it's a very important sequence of events. Steroids are now considered to be the backbone of therapy for patients with acute interstitial nephritis, particularly if it's a very fulminant event. But even the subclinical ones, simply removing the drug nowadays is not considered enough because by the time you wash out all those metabolites, once you turn on the immune system, it could take weeks for it to recover, and by then fibrosis had settled in. So your job is to remember that the importance of this is distinguishing between those drugs that cause ATN, in which you do nothing but sit back and remove the offending drug, and those drugs that cause AIN, acute interstitial nephritis, in which case not only do you remove the drug, but then you talk to your colleagues and you say, I think steroids are mandatory in this patient, and you embark on a whole course of steroid therapy that may have its own consequences, but at least you're doing the right thing for the right disease. Drugs are responsible for the majority of cases of acute interstitial nephritis. This is a disease that's increasing in frequency, more polypharmacy, an older population. So in the United States, the incidence is going up. In Europe, UK, the incidence is going up, and it's going up particularly in the elderly population. Where it used to be that the average age was in the 40s, now the average age of interstitial nephritis is in the 60s. So the older population seems to be particularly more prone to this, and I believe it's because we simply have so many more prescriptions. I mean, half the time in an office visit is the nurse inputting all the medications the patient is on for their heart failure, diabetes, hypertension, and lipid abnormalities. So it's no wonder that eventually some drug in there is going to cause an allergic reaction. For us to understand this disease process, I just wanted to share with you just a little anatomy about the kidney and what exactly we mean by saying interstitial nephritis. Because there are certain manifestations of this disease clinically and biochemically. Once you understand where the disease occurs, you'll know, aha, that's why I'm seeing this electrolyte abnormality. That's why I'm seeing this clinical event of painful kidneys. So where is the interstitium of the kidney? The interstitium of the kidney is all that space that exists between the tubules and the glomeruli. So when you think of the kidney itself, we're all focused on the glomerulus. We're all focused on the proximal tubule and the distal tubule and the collecting ducts. We forget that all that is embedded in some type of structural support, and that structural support is the interstitium. So when you look at, this is one of the original drawings of the kidney itself, all the glomeruli and the tubules don't just float in the middle of nothing. They have to be embedded in a gelatinous substance that gives the kidney its shape and form. And so this material that forms the ground substance of the kidney, that completes the space between the glomeruli, that hold the glomeruli in the cortex, in the tubules in the medulla, this background material is vitally important. It isn't just the structural support. It has no meaningful activity. It is a very biologically active compartment of the kidney. Here we have a typical single glomerulus, and everyone always looks first at the glomerulus. Where is the interstitial space in this picture? So here is the glomerulus itself. Here are the tubules. And notice the tubules, they have no privacy. I was just in Japan, and there's nothing like being in rush hour in Japan when police push you into the subway to fit enough people there. You are touching everyone on every side of you. There's no private space around you. That's what the tubules live with every day. The tubules basically touch each other every day. They have no personal sense of individuality. And so this little space, in these little triangular areas between the tubules, that's the interstitial space. Anything that inflames that space will spread the tubules apart and completely disrupt their function. So normally, the interstitial space in the kidney is a small little compartment in between the tubules, holding everything together. The interstitial space is a biologically active area. And for our residents, for everyone in training, you should realize that there are certain cells in the interstitium that produce vitally important hormones. One of the most important hormones they make are the prostaglandins that help control the autoregulation of the blood flow and the tubules. But most importantly, they produce vitamin D, the active form of vitamin D. Interstitial nephritis reduces your ability to produce active vitamin D, and anybody with interstitial disease suffers very severe bone disease, much more so than anybody else with other forms of glomerular disease. This is a big distinguishing feature between those diseases like diabetes that causes glomerular disease, hypertension that causes just a vascular shriveling up of the glomerulus. These unique diseases cause a propensity for severe osteomalacia, brittle bones, fractures, kyphosis, collapse of the spine because of impaired vitamin D production very early in the disease. We have patients, the cells in the interstitium also make our famous hormone, erythropoietin. So when you talk about anemia of kidney disease, we talk about it like it's a global term. Well, sure, everybody with chronic kidney disease will develop anemia. But among the kidney diseases, people with interstitial disease are much more anemic than the person with glomerular disease. Because when you have glomerular disease, like diabetes, it does not affect the interstitium. And so therefore, you only get anemic at the very, very, very advanced stages. People with interstitial disease get anemic right away, very quickly, because they lose erythropoietin production. So especially for our house officers in training, left with a patient with kidney injury, and you don't know like when it occurred, you see the creatinine, people that are unusually anemic, people that have unusually low calcium levels because of lack of vitamin D, I'm suspecting the point of their injury is more in the interstitium than it would be in the glomerulus. So it is a very important part of the kidney, particularly for bone health, particularly for erythropoietin production. It has the cells in the interstitium are very simple. A fibroblast here or there, a stem cell here and there, mononuclear cells here and there. What does not exist in the interstitium are lymphocytes. What do not exist in the interstitium are eosinophils. And you know, that is the hallmark of delayed type hypersensitivity. When you develop a type 4 hypersensitivity, you get an influx of T lymphocytes that are now going to destroy all the tubules. And then, by the way, a few eosinophils follow also. But the majority are going to be lymphocytes. Acute interstitial nephritis can be a result of many different diseases. We're concentrating on the most common, which is drug-induced, something we are responsible for. Among the drugs that cause acute interstitial nephritis, it's basically almost a tie between antibiotics as a class and all other drugs. And antibiotics we can understand and we'll put them to the side. But among the other drugs that are responsible for acute interstitial nephritis, notice that the PPIs rank number one. And we've already stressed that. So this is something that has become increasingly clear, and I'll show you the data epidemiologically, that in the United States and the world, the number one cause of interstitial nephritis causing acute kidney injury that could lead to chronic kidney injury is the frequent use of PPIs. And it causes this slow, insidious destruction of the kidney by a type B ADR, a delayed type hypersensitivity. So yes, NSAIDs, all other drugs can do this. Any drug can cause an allergic reaction of a type 4 hypersensitivity. But on the list, dominating the factor, are all classes of the PPIs. So one class is not unique in this regard. And that's why this topic is very important to us. So we recognize, do we really need to keep our patients on that drug indefinitely because they like to eat Mexican food and they get heartburn all the time? And you know, doc, it works, so I'm just going to refill it all the time. But is it really fitting the criteria of something that's mandatory to use? So this is a type 4 hypersensitivity reaction. Causes acute interstitial nephritis, the space between the tubules, affecting the functional aspect of the kidney. T lymphocytes are predominant. People always pay attention, again, especially in students in their textbooks, it says eosinophils. That's just a small component of it. Eosinophils are scavengers. They're just taking advantage of the inflammation. So they're attracted there later on. The major injury is by active T lymphocytes. So that's why steroids are so important, because their direct toxic effect will be on T lymphocytes. This is not antibody mediated. There are no B cells. There's no IgG. This is T cell mediated injury of the kidney. So what happens, and if you remember the picture of the single glomerulus before, thousands of lymphocytes infiltrate in the kidney, causing inflammation of the tubules, nephritis, interstitial nephritis, tubulitis, inflammation of all the tubules, destroying their functional capacity. The glomerulus is usually unaffected. This is a form of type 4 hypersensitivity reaction, a delayed type. Eosinophils are attracted in there, but they are a secondary feature and never, never the most prominent cell type. So eosinophils are there and allow us to recognize it perhaps on a blood smear or in the urine, but they are not what's causing the major injury. It is a lymphocyte-mediated effect. So we believe what happens is your drug class, whether it's an NSAID, whether it's an antibiotic, whether it's a PPI, somehow gets structurally altered in the kidney. So that could occur in the kidney itself. The drug can actually bind to the tubules, causing it to become more antigenic. It can form a hapten with other proteins. It could be degraded and change the surface markers of the tubules. The proximal tubule absorbs almost everything. So once the PPI or derivatives get stuck in the proximal tubule, it may alter its immunogenicity and you become non-self. Basically, this is rejection. For those of you that know transplant immunology, you know that kidney transplant rejection is type 4 hypersensitivity. It's T cells going into somebody else's organ. We can understand it. It's non-self. In this situation, those drugs caused your kidney to become foreign to you. They've changed the markers on the surface of the tubules because of the structure of the drug itself or the way the kidney degrades it. So that's why the kidney, as opposed to any other part of your body, gets inflamed. We don't see lung inflammation. We don't see liver inflammation. This is uniquely related inside the kidney. It's rejection of your own kidneys. And so this is acute interstitial nephritis due to type 4 hypersensitivity, causing self to become non-self. And this is, in general, we have many explanations on why all of a sudden these drugs cause your kidney to appear different, how it alters the structure of the cells. It's a class effect. So if a drug falls in a certain class, all derivatives and generics of that same class will be similarly affected. It has to do with the backbone structure of the drug itself, causing interstitial nephritis. The typical presentation that's on most examinations is this. After 5 to 7 days, the patient presents with a triad of fever, rash, and eosinophilia. No one on a step exam or in-service exam would ever miss that because the patient all of a sudden has, you know, fever, rash, and eosinophils in the blood. We're allergic to something, and maybe you look at the urine, and all of a sudden you see even eosinophils in the urine. So this is the classic presentation that never occurs in reality. You never see all three of these things, this holy trinity, at the same time. Fewer than 10% of patients ever manifest all of these at the same time. The rash may be fleeting and you may not even see it. One day there could be eosinophils in the blood, next day there may not be. It's very transient. So it looks great on paper, but that's not what you see when you're at the bedside. So it's like the patient didn't read the textbook. They're not presenting the way I thought they would present. But this is the typical presentation of an acute allergic interstitial nephritis. The rash is not toxic epidermal necrolysis. Your skin doesn't fall off. This is not Stevens-Johnson syndrome. This is a macular papular eruption with dermatographism. You blanch it, you push your skin in, it blanches. This is an inflammatory state. Lots of chemokines and cytokines are being released. So this is pretty obvious when it's there, but it may just be very patchy. It could be diffuse when you get TEN. That's a much more advanced effect. Most of our patients, just a very fleeting macular papular eruption. The urine is your key. And most of the time, we may not be comfortable, you know, getting regular urinalyses on our patients. You need to always get, of course, a urinalysis in anybody with acute kidney injury, for certain. You want to see exactly what the cause of that kidney injury is. And in the urine of a patient with acute tubular necrosis, as you know, the only main thing you see are what's called granular casts, debris of the tubules that are now necrotic. That is not the urine of somebody with inflammation. Somebody with acute interstitial nephritis has lots of blood in the urine, and most importantly, lots of white cells in the urine. I cannot tell you how often patients are misidentified as having a UTI. The creatinine's up a little bit. The urine is very dirty with white cells and red cells. And the physician says, must be a UTI, take Bactrim. And they give Cipro and then Bactrim, and it's just not getting any better. And all that inflammation, and the cultures are negative, and you go, well, it's negative because I was already pre-treating the patient, and maybe it was partial. And so I can't understand why the culture's always negative, but the urine keeps having white cells in it. White cells are lymphocytes. They're not PMNs. And so this is a misleading identification on the urinalysis. Most of these are lymphocytes, and this is a type 4 hypersensitivity. Don't be misled into thinking this is an infection. You see blood in the urine. You see white cells in the urine, some casts in the urine. Creatinine's inching up a little bit. The patient may have a low-grade fever. That could be a UTI, of course. But if the creatinine's going up, why would infection of the bladder cause my kidney to malfunction? Because if the creatinine go up, both kidneys have to be involved. And so this is an interstitial nephritis. We see granular casts with red cells and white cells. Acute interstitial nephritis is tubular injury, so I get the ATN part, plus I get the inflammation part. And the inflammation part are all the red cells and white cells with even white cell casts. So white cell casts, we always say, are a sign of pyelonephritis. This is one of those exceptions where white cell casts are a result of inflammation of the kidney with immunological, not bacteriologic effects. So it's the whole scenario together, but I can't emphasize enough how dirty the urine will look compared to somebody with ATN. Because in ATN, I don't give steroids, but in this, I'm giving steroids because of the inflammation. Many studies continue to emphasize now the importance of white cell casts. Again, the doctors can be misled by giving antibiotics for this for weeks and then finally realizing this is not a urine infection, and by then irreversible fibrosis has settled in. And again, the last thing on the mind on why the creatinine could be going up would be, for instance, that PPI. So we want to make sure we keep a high degree of suspicion on considering these aspects in patients that present this way. We always talk about eosinophils in the urine. Half the time, the laboratory doesn't collect it properly, and we don't really know how to interpret the results. Eosinophils in the urine are so inaccurate that it's actually been removed now from any diagnostic capacity. What percent of the urine white cells are eosinophils? Is it 1%? Is it any eosinophils? Is it 1%? Is it 5%? People have set a cutoff of 1%, but many things can cause urine eosinophils. UTIs can do it. Prostatitis can do it. Even ATN occasionally. So yes, eosinophils in the urine are a great test question, always. But in reality, we don't really use that effectively on the wards with any degree of sensitivity and specificity. Sure, we send it off for completeness, but it is not in the criteria, and it is so inaccurate that it really isn't a true part of the diagnosis of this disease. It's the clinical experience, the way they presented, the urine sediment, that's much more typical for us to suspect. Radiologically, there's a very interesting thing that happens to these kidneys. They get larger. They get larger because they're swollen. They're swollen because of all the inflammation, and water enters the kidney and stretches the kidney and makes it physically bigger. In ATN, the kidneys do not change their shape. There's no increased echogenicity. There's no pain with ATN. In this disease, patients complain of flank pain, again, misleading the physician to think that this is pyelonephritis. You get bilateral flank pain. You don't get bilateral flank pain with pyelonephritis. Both my kidneys hurt, my back hurts, the creatinine's going up, I have a dirty urinary sediment. That's AIN, that's not an infection. We need to jump on that right away and see what other drugs this patient's taking, what can we remove, maybe this patient needs steroids, do they need, even need a biopsy? Ultrasound is helpful, but very interestingly, it's nice to do a scan that's particularly unique to inflammation with T cells and macrophages, the gallium scan. Gallium scans are a poor man's biopsy. If you can't do the biopsy for bleeding coagulopathy and we're not sure the patient's strong enough to go to the nephrologist and we really can't biopsy, you do a gallium scan. And if the kidney really is inflamed with type 4 hypersensitivity, it will light up because of all the inflammatory cells inside. And if you really want to spend a lot of money here at Boca Regional Hospital, order a PET scan and see if they'll allow you to do that. A PET scan really will light up in this disease, but obviously it's extremely costly. The whole idea is that the kidney is infiltrated with cells, and we want a scan that will show that infiltration. Gallium scans are now considered to be a reasonable choice when a biopsy can't be done, and even PET scans are even more accurate than that, but again, the cost involved. So interstitial nephritis is inflammation of the tubules, and normally it does not affect the glomerulus, so there won't be much protein in the urine. But occasionally, certain drugs can cause nephrotic range proteinuria, particularly the non-steroidals. If there's any one thing also to take home from this morning is the fact that a patient on any of the non-steroidals, whether it's a cyclooxygenase 1 or cyclooxygenase 2 inhibitor, a COX-1 or COX-2 inhibitor, either of them could potentially affect the glomerulus and cause minimal change disease or membranous disease, in which case you get nephrotic syndrome and you get inflammation of the tubules. So I get acute interstitial nephritis and a lot of protein in the urine. But by and large, these are separate and distinct compartments of the kidney. Diseases that affect my tubules do not affect the glomerulus. Diabetes and focal sclerosis and diseases that affect the glomerulus don't affect my tubules. But occasionally, we see an overlap, particularly with the NSAIDs. So if I see a patient with arthritic condition, fibromyalgia, chronic rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis that's taking NSAIDs, and they're nephrotic, think of the NSAID, because that very much could be a drug-related nephrotic syndrome. NSAIDs cause, as we've talked about here before, numerous diseases. And here we want to add on to this list the possibility of nephrotic syndrome for minimal change disease, membranous disease, and interstitial nephritis. So, of course, we're all familiar with the NSAID side effects, but most uniquely, we've not talked about the fact they can affect your glomerulus and actually cause nephrotic syndrome. Interferon, NSAIDs, occasionally a few other drugs can actually cause nephrotic range proteinuria. Acute tubular necrosis, acute interstitial nephritis. You must be familiar with distinguishing between these two. The time of onset of ATN, predictable based on drug dosing and duration, days to weeks. But AIN, often 5 to 7 days, a week or two, but can be months later. That's the most important part. Delayed type hypersensitivity. It could be 3, 4, 6 months, a year after you consistently take it for you to see now this inflammatory response occurring. The kidneys are large and tender. Occasionally you see a fever and a rash. None of those are present in ATN. The fractional excretion of sodium, the urine sodium, is going to be high because you're damaging the tubules. That does not distinguish one from the other. But in the urine, we have the inflammation. Granular casts with white cell casts and red cells. I emphasize the PPI not just because Dr. Rosenthal is my good friend and I want to damn his profession for damaging the kidneys, but because these are the number one causes of acute interstitial nephritis in the United States and the world. So most of the time, as you can see here, if you go by FDA guidelines, half the people are taking them inappropriately because they've tried it, it works. The inertia is the doctor doesn't want to argue with them, so okay, let's just refill it again because it's the least harmful of everything else the patient's taking. And now I'm showing you how really serious it could be simply to keep refilling these drugs in a patient who could possibly have some chronic kidney disease. This may be responsible for that. PPIs in an article that was just published a few months ago, are associated with numerous systemic side effects, all the way from hypomagnesemia, which may play a role in the kidney damage, an increased fracture rate, an increased risk of C. diff, dementia, and now we're saying that acute and chronic kidney injury have to be a part and parcel of the potential side effects of being on PPIs. The prevalence of using PPIs is exploding. The commercials are everywhere. Internet, people have word of mouth, and so we see this in all major studies. The use of PPIs is growing dramatically, both here and in Europe. And so we have no doubt that patients are heavily exposed to this. Two major trials have linked and are one of the first to link the effect of PPIs on causing acute kidney injury. So here were two studies that were not intended to look at the risk of PPIs on the kidney. They were atherosclerotic trials, hypertension trials, but yet they inadvertently found a link between people who were taking PPIs and the odds ratio for developing acute kidney injury, very powerful in thousands of patients in two major studies. And this spread across all major studies now analyzing this risk factor of acute and chronic kidney injury. With duration of use, effect of chronic kidney disease increases. Studies have confirmed this time and time again. VA cooperative studies, yes, diabetes causes chronic kidney disease, hypertension, male sex, black race, all these typical factors, PPI use. So all these studies confirm that among your list now of potential causal factors for chronic and acute kidney disease are the use of PPIs. So in any patient on a PPI who has acute kidney injury or even chronic kidney injury, you've got to suspect the PPI. And all these studies from the original studies in Australia, New Zealand, to the United States, the odds ratios may differ a little bit. But what we know for sure is older patients are more susceptible, and it is statistically clear that PPIs are a very important cause of both acute and chronic disease. And what's mostly of concern, the why I'm on the pulpit here preaching about this, is that there is such a delay in recognizing this that once you find it and you stop the PPI, the patients don't recover adequate kidney function again. It isn't reversible because we've waited too long. So patients that have had acute kidney injury from PPIs and the drugs were stopped, this is how poor the kidney function was when they finally recognized something was related to the PPI and they stopped the PPIs. Renal function recovered, but never back to pre-baseline level. So these patients were indeed left with chronic kidney disease. And you know, anyone with chronic kidney disease has an explosive risk of atherosclerotic heart disease and death from cardiovascular disease. So once you leave somebody with CKD, you have already given them an increased risk of death. And so the fact that they never fully recover now puts them in a high-risk category for premature death from cardiovascular disease. That's the important link. CKD is a serious cause of life-threatening accelerated atherogenesis. These patients now are worse off than they were when they started because of likely a delay in finally recognizing that the PPI was responsible and treatment was not initiated, the drug wasn't stopped, and now there's permanent fibrosis. As opposed to the Bactrim and the sulfur drugs and many other drugs that present with rash and fever and eosinophilia, as we emphasize, these do not. Do not expect to find a rash. Do not expect to find eosinophils in the urine. It is a very slow, insidious hypersensitivity reaction. The body doesn't show much, any physical manifestations of it, except for the urine and except for the rising creatinine. That's it. That's why you have to be detectives and real CSI nephrology. You've got to really make sure that you have a keen sense of suspicion. Why does this patient have this change of creatinine? And look at their drug list and see if one of these can be implicated. This article just came out a month ago, and I love the title. Proton pump inhibitors and kidney disease, GI upset for the nephrologist. Yes, you are giving me lots of business. And so with the PPIs, and all the studies were reviewed, and they showed the odds ratios were ridiculous, 1.7, 1.5, 1.4, a 50, 70%, 100% increase in acute kidney injury. The nephrologists are feeding off this frenzy of PPIs as an important cause of kidney injury. It is real. This was from just a few weeks ago. That was from last month. A few weeks ago, this study came out in April, showing once again the odds ratio of acute kidney injury. Astounding. 2.78 is a ridiculous number for the risk factor for AKI. It's as high as aminoglycosides. And then we have CKD, also 1.5. All these studies, this is not a statistical quirk, so this is important for us to recognize. We have to realize understanding how it happens, we leave that for the scientists. You know, all the different ideas of how the structure may be altered causing hypersensitivity, that is important. But one thing does stick out, and that's the low magnesium. Hypomagnesemia in and of itself could be a risk factor for inflammation of the kidney. And it's now clear that there is indeed a palpable risk and association between the hypomagnesemia that's induced by the PPIs and one of the causative factors that may be influencing the fibrosis of the kidney. So making sure that you get magnesium levels on these patients are important, and low magnesium must be treated because it could be linked to inflammation of the kidney. Very interesting data that has come out. And in nephrology, we do believe magnesium could be an important contributing factor to some fibrosis and scarring in the kidney. Not to put the GI specialty completely at risk, but another drug that's commonly given for inflammatory bowel disease, an aminosalicylate derivative, same thing. This is a drug that's, you know, unsuspectingly important in regard to kidney injury. Acicol, Pentaza, drugs that are used for inflammatory bowel disease, it's just like the PPIs. It's slow, it's insidious, it is an NSAID derivative, it does cause a type 4 hypersensitivity, and slowly but surely can cause chronic scarring of the kidney. I also want, for completeness, to emphasize data that you may not be familiar with, and that's that the protease inhibitors, we all know they cause crystals, but now they're also commonly linked to interstitial nephritis. Any drug can do it. So we just keep that high suspicion. ATN is one thing, inflammation is the other. And for people in oncology, this is just a report just last the other week in the New England Journal, a case report, also emphasized how important this brand new class of drugs are. I don't prescribe them. I'm not even sure exactly how they work, but they're called checkpoint inhibitors. And we do understand that by releasing the immune system, you have an anti-oncologic effect, boost the immune system, increase T cell effect to try to eradicate foreign cancer cells, but at the same time, you cause autoimmunity. And it's now clear that people getting checkpoint inhibitors, while very successful in certain malignancies, dramatically increases your risk of autoimmunity, and especially in the kidney, causing acute interstitial nephritis. We are now seeing from the Sylvester Cancer Center a number of cases of people getting checkpoint inhibitors with acute kidney injury related to interstitial nephritis and inflammation from the use of checkpoint inhibitors. Years ago, of course, cisplatinum, ifosfamide, cyclophosphamide, we're all familiar with those, but it's hard to keep up with these newer oncologic agents. But because this is in the literature, and this is our topic for today, I definitely want to make sure you realize and keep in mind, checkpoint inhibitors, something we don't normally deal with, are a big cause right now of autoimmunity. Now, you could say, are my diagnostic skills, after everything I've told you today about the urine and the eosinophils and the fever rash, am I good enough to diagnose this without a biopsy? Am I Dr. House? Well, if you use all your diagnostic expertise and you say, I believe this person has ATN, you miss about 22% of cases that actually have acute interstitial nephritis. If you say that I believe on all my diagnostic criteria that I heard about in this lecture that this patient has AIN, well, 44% have AIN, and majority of people had other causes of kidney injury like ATN. So it's very hard on clinical criteria alone to truly be confident you've made your diagnosis. Biopsies are inevitable to really confirm it. If you can't do a biopsy, we do the scans like a gallium scan. Fibrosis can occur in 7 days. That, I think, is people don't realize and accept the reality that it doesn't take weeks for permanent fibrosis of the kidney to develop. We've seen it now as quick as 7 days. So that's why it's so important to jump on this right away, because you will be left with permanent irreversible fibrosis even as quick as 7 days of inflammation of the kidney itself. Preventing this, preventing the onset of chronic kidney disease is our goal. And as we mentioned, if you miss it, you're left with chronic kidney disease. And the data shows that people that have PPI-induced kidney injury, people on NSAIDs, the majority of them only have partial recoveries or no recoveries compared to people with antibiotic-induced AIN. The reason that this is so easy to recover is because most people with antibiotics, they have the rash, they have the fever. It's much more fulminant. This is more insidious, in which case the results are not as clear. Early use of steroids is imperative. So the earlier you start steroids, the greater the reduction in the risk of fibrosis. If you wait 3 weeks, 4 weeks, or a month, you get the poorest response. So you really have to initiate it often within a week or so of making this diagnosis. So all the studies show that steroids have a beneficial effect compared to just doing nothing and removing the drug. The GFRs are significantly higher. The creatinines are lower in people who receive steroids compared to people in whom you simply stop the drug and step back and just let the drug wear off. And I think that makes sense for all of us based on everything we spoke about now. The GFRs are higher in people getting steroids. The risk of end-stage kidney disease is lower in people who got steroids. And we're talking about prednisone. Prednisone often as high as 60 to 80 milligrams a day for weeks until you see recovery. So people that get steroids have a significantly better chance of recovering. Depending on the severity, I may give them IV steroids, but usually it's 1 milligram per kilogram, and we continue that for 6 weeks. You want to continue it for a substantial period of time to ensure you've eradicated that immune response. You don't take this lightly. Diabetes, hypertension, the mood effects, the psychotropic effects, all these things, your patient is really going to be, you know, affected by high-dose steroids, but the alternative is leaving them with chronic kidney disease. So once you embark on it, we want to embark on it with certainty because we definitely are helping to avoid CKD. The guidelines right now say that if you suspect acute interstitial nephritis and you stop the drug, and within 5 days, a week at the most, if you haven't seen a substantial recovery, you need to start steroids because you cannot waste time. Now, you could start steroids even before getting a biopsy because there's really no major harm unless there's sepsis of giving a few days of prednisone, and then if the biopsy comes back ATN or something else, you just stop them acutely. So the key is pull the trigger quickly if you really suspect this person has AIN. So we're talking about AIN that results from drugs that could lead to chronic kidney disease if poorly treated. For our last minute or so, I just want to tell you that it's not always so easy to treat because there are some drugs that go directly from the drug effect all the way to chronic scarring with no inflammatory response whatsoever, no ability to give steroids. These drugs are pro-fibrotic, and so there's no ability to avert it unless you monitor the drug dosing itself. Of the drugs that do this, you are familiar with the majority of them. People that overuse analgesics, Tylenol, acetaminophen, and NSAIDs in a cocktail for years and years. These drugs chronically cause fibrosis, but there's never any chance of giving them steroids because there's no inflammatory component. In transplant, the calcineurin inhibitors, cyclosporin and tacrolimus cause direct fibrosis. But more important for your daily practice, the poster child of this is lithium. Lithium given for bipolar disease, no inflammation, but after 10 years and 15 years, chronic fibrosis of the kidney, even with properly monitored trough levels. So this is just an accumulating effect of a metal being absorbed by the kidney, causing a chronic fibrosis of the kidney. We have herbs and heavy metals and toxins, but lithium is your poster child along with analgesics. Analgesics given for years at a time, daily, cause chronic fibrosis, and nothing can reverse that, which is why we're so important to take a history on chronic pain syndromes in our patients. Years of chronic analgesic use have to be avoided in our patients. Analgesics cause necrosis of the papilla of the kidney, papillary necrosis, a hallmark of this disease. The papilla literally necroses and falls off, which is unique to this disease. Lithium for bipolar disease, chronic fibrosis, but no inflammatory state. So what I've hoped to have spoken with you about this morning to impart upon you is the importance of ADRs, adverse drug reactions, understanding the difference between type A and type B. Type A is potentially avoidable if we properly dose these drugs with the help of pharmacy and limit their duration, particularly with patients with comorbid conditions, dehydration, the elderly patients, heart failure. We can modify that risk. It's the type Bs we never can expect. They just happen. But yet when they happen, we have to recognize it. And we said that PPIs, NSAIDs, sulfur drugs, all of these can cause acute interstitial nephritis. And the most important is recognizing it so it does not lead to chronic disease and CKD. There are some drugs which don't have that inflammatory component. Lithium and analgesics are the poster child. So please keep in mind drug nephrotoxicity. Be on the lookout, because unless you think about it, you'll never have that opportunity to intercede early on. Thank you very much for your attention, and go out and look at all the pharmacy lists of your patients. Yes? Excuse me? So gadolinium is a very important drug that causes fibrosis of the body, but not of the kidneys. So the one thing that gadolinium does spare are the kidneys, but it causes esophageal, pulmonary, skin, a scleroderma effect. So definitely, as you heard, giving gadolinium to somebody with chronic kidney disease, the gadolinium dissociates, and that causes inflammation. So it's a chronic fibrosis, but it's not an interstitial nephritis. There's no inherent nephrotoxicity of gadolinium. It's one of our favorite test questions for students. Contrast is nephrotoxic, but gadolinium is not. But gadolinium is systemically toxic. They call that disease nephrogenic systemic fibrosis. Nephrogenic doesn't mean it's nephrotoxic. It's because the kidney was responsible for the fibrosis, NSF. Yes?
If you see AIN associated with the PPIs, and you said you can possibly wait 5 to 7 days, are you really going to see an improvement 5 to 7 days?
Well, exactly. So, I mean, unless there's some dramatic improvement, most of these patients, particularly with PPIs, are steroids. The antibiotics, they can improve relatively quickly. But for PPIs and NSAIDs, it's most likely steroids. Yeah.
And then, again, how long would you use the steroids for?
6 weeks.
6 weeks.
I would slowly taper it down after I made sure they stayed on a high dose. If I'm seeing improvement, continue it, because the perpetuation of the delayed type hypersensitivity it goes on autopilot. And until these cells turn over, their structure is altered. So the PPI is worn off, but the haptens, the change of the proximal tubular antigens, will persist until those cells turn over.
So would you follow both the urinalysis and
their... Your analysis would have to show less blood, less inflammation. And then, of course, kidney function may be a little delayed because it is ATN, but definitely I want to see an improving urinalysis. Have a great Memorial weekend. Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to share the kidney with you. Thank you.